Hello, I'm Charles Kenville. This is number 0590, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0590. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, science writer Andrew Vazakis, the night sky guy, talks about the collapse of the Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico.
I think the whole astronomical community is really mourning this amazing facility. And I don't even think it's just the astronomical community. I think it's the world at large. I think so many of us, you know, even those that know nothing about astronomy or telescopes, has seen or heard of this facility in Puerto Rico. It's so iconic for 60 years now almost. You know, it's been in movies, comics, so it's in pop culture too, and it's really sad that now it's met its demise.
Mark Hartzman from WeirdHistorian.com on the theft of Charlie Chaplin's body.
These guys, a couple of Eastern Europeans, got a new idea to rob a grave and then ask for a ransom. So they thought they could cash in on the death of Charlie Chaplin. So they go out, they dig up the grave. He had a 300-pound oak coffin, and then they put it on their little truck and they drive all the way out to a cornfield far from the home in Switzerland, and they reburied it. And then they call up Charlie's wife, his widow, whose name was Una, and they have this ransom demand, which was 1 million francs. They give these ransom demands, and she says no.
Paul J.J. Payak from the Global Language Monitor on the trending words of 2020. As you can well imagine, in a year like no other, one word sticks out like no other ever has.
Not even close. In some instantiations, we've had over a billion citations. We've never seen anything close to that. A billion citations worldwide to 7 billion people on Earth. So that just gives you an idea to scale. We've never had anything that was so globally focused. It's always focused on English language, which covers a lot of the globe, but this covers everything. You know, you just look at the COVID map of the world right now from John Hopkins University, and it's truly frightening.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0590, was Charles Kenville from localis.com. That's localis.com, a search engine for locally made products. Now, right now, it's just in Quebec, but it will soon also include makers, manufacturers, and retailers from all across Canada that are made in Canada. So congratulations, Charles, on coming up with this innovative idea. And thank you very much for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And don't forget to check out the totally revamped Stuff File program website, which has information on all the guests of the show going back to the very first program way back in 2009, almost 600 shows over 11 years, and you can play any or all of them right from the site. So go get your info on and head down memory lane at thestufffile.com. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? You know how many in the United States warned that gatherings at Thanksgiving could turn out to be deadly? Somehow, I don't think this is what they had in mind. 29-year-old James Dixon of Chicago was arrested and charged with first-degree murder after a Thanksgiving get-together ended in the death of 52-year-old Vincel Jackson, the host's boyfriend. In the early hours of November 27th, prosecutors said an argument broke out after Dixon used his bare hands to help himself to holiday meal leftovers, and Jackson forcibly escorted him to the home's front door. So, I'm guessing at this point, Jackson cast fate to the wind while casting Dixon to the front door and also tossed out social distancing as well. Assistant State's Attorney Susie Boccaro said the altercation moved out to the front porch, where a witness found Jackson stabbed 9 times. He was pronounced dead at a hospital, and Dixon was arrested 8 hours later with a blood-covered knife in his possession. Wow. That must have been some meal. Really good eats. If you're going to stab someone 9 times just to get leftovers, you had better ask for the recipe, too. But let's back up just a second. Who grabs food with their bare hands? Please tell me this doesn't include the mashed potatoes and gravy. Yeah. Well, surely right about now we could all use a story that sounds like a fairy tale, right? How about this? Police in Kansas City, Kansas, responded to a call on November 27th from a man who said he returned home at around 4 p.m. that day to find a stranger in his house. The unnamed suspect was wearing the victim's clothing, had made a sandwich and cooked and ate ramen noodles, and when police arrived, was fast asleep in the victim's bed. The man was arrested and booked into the Wyandotte County Jail, where I'm sure the beds were surely too hard. Yeah. Well, this next story is just awkward. A Bend, Oregon man who sought professional help for depression resulting from his crumbling marriage likely didn't take things too well when he reportedly found out the doctor he was seeing was allegedly having an affair with his wife. Pearson Tone is suing the doctor, Ronald Rosen, for $2.9 million for professional negligence for the loss of his marriage and emotional and social destruction of his family. Tone alleges he, his wife, and his children received medical care at Rosen's clinic between 2015 and 2018. During that period, the lawsuit alleges the doctor started having an affair with Tone's wife. In November of 2018, Tone reportedly sought Rosen to help treat his depression, which resulted from the stress of his rocky marriage. Rosen counseled the heartbroken man and prescribed him herbs, marijuana, and CBD to help with his depression. The lawsuit claims Tone later found his wife was in an extramarital affair with the doctor for an extended period of time. The marriage ultimately faltered, and the once happy couple divorced. Wow. Wonder who his lawyer was sleeping with. Also, I wonder what kind of health coverage he had. I know his wife had full coverage, or maybe even a flexible plan. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, after a heated argument with his wife in late November, a 48-year-old unnamed man from Como, Italy, stepped outside to walk it off and kept on walking until he was stopped a week later by police officers patrolling after curfew in Jamara, which is more than 260 miles away. The man said he had walked the entire way without using any other modes of transportation and relied on the kindness of strangers for food and drink. "I'm fine. I'm just a little tired," he said. His wife, who had reported him missing, picked him up the next day, but had to pay a fine of almost $500 for his violation of the curfew. Oh my Lord! Could you just imagine the conversation on the way back home in the car? What are the chances of the husband leaping from that moving vehicle? And I'm even sure the odds wouldn't differ much based on whether he was driving or not. I mean, if you can get into an argument with your spouse to the point where you keep walking in a straight line for 260 miles, your relationship is pretty much doomed. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we?
Now, the Stuff File presents Andrew Fazekas, the Night Sky Guy. It's radio that's out of this world.
Andrew Fazekas is a member of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada and the author of National Geographic's Backyard Guide to the Night Sky. And we don't normally have Andrew on 2 weeks in a row, but The collapse of a famed observatory telescope in Puerto Rico kind of warrants it. So, hi, Andrew.
Hi, Peter.
So, what's the deal with this telescope, and how important has this been in its over 50-year life?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really sad situation. I think the whole astronomical community is really mourning this amazing facility. And let me take that back. I don't even think it's just the astronomical community. I think it's the world at large. I think so many of us, you know, even those that know nothing about astronomy or telescopes has seen or heard of this facility in Puerto Rico. It's so iconic, this radio telescope that's built into a valley, you know, in the hills of Puerto Rico for 60 years now almost. And so, you know, it's been in movies, comics. So it's in pop culture too. And it's really sad that now it's met its demise. It was kind of, it's not totally surprising for those that in the field. We knew that it was damaged quite severely, especially since this summer. Some cables actually broke that held this really heavy infrastructure that sits at the top of it. It's a 900-ton platform that contains instruments that sits in just, you know, above the dish, this giant 1,000 feet across dish, and some cables broke that had been holding it. A set broke in August, early August, and then in November another set broke, and then it damaged it mortally. So much so that they said it was irreparable, and it was destined to be, it was decommissioned, the facility, and it was destined to be demolished. But before they could actually do anything, on December 1st, some other cables, major last remaining cables, broke that held the suspended platform of science experiments, and it just completely collapsed. It's worth watching the video. It's so stunning to see this entire thing collapse into the center of the dish, and so it's completely demolished now.
Yeah, I've seen that video. It is quite remarkable. And you mentioned the attention that this telescope received through its life. Two films were used or shot there. GoldenEye, Pierce Brosnan's first Bond movie, had a scene there. And, of course, Jodie Foster and Contact was shot there partially. And it received some 90,000 visitors a year. So it was very, very popular. But besides its popularity, what are some of the major feats that it helped to discover?
Oh my gosh, there's just a whole lineup of stuff. I guess some of the big things that it's been involved in is understanding what pulsars are, for instance. Pulsars are these basically dead stars that rotate extremely quickly, like a lighthouse beaming out light in every direction. And they are considered one of the major staples of astronomical objects in the universe. The astronomers who made this discovery of binary pulsars, two of these objects rotating around each other, they actually won a Nobel Prize in physics for that work. That was back in 1974. And many of us may have heard of that. The first kind of message into space was sent from the Arecibo Observatory. Back in 1974, scientists actually used this radio telescope to transmit out a message of, you know, that had basic information about humanity and our knowledge, mapping of the solar system, illustration of a human being, the atomic number and of certain elements. All of that was beamed in a coded message that was sent out into space to one particular point. Actually, it was a globular star cluster. It's basically this big city of stars that sits over 24,000 4,000 light years away. So it's so far away that this message is still beaming out there on its way to that star cluster. Yeah, because it's so far away, it'll take tens of thousands of years to reach it. So, you know, and even today, they've been working on looking at exoplanets. In fact, one of the first exoplanets was discovered with Arecibo back in 1992, and it's been used in the last two decades, particularly to investigate asteroids. What was very special, Peter, about Arecibo is that it was one of the few instruments in the world radio telescopes that not only can receive radio signals, but can of course transmit them. So other than just making, you know, sending out messages, it was able to basically create radar maps of incoming asteroids that would come fly by Earth very close. And of course, you and I have talked many times about, you know, potential hazards that inward coming asteroids can pose. Well, the Arecibo facility was pivotal in our ability to understand the trajectories, the pathways of asteroids that come close to Earth regularly. So this is going to be a huge miss for scientists, and many are actually wondering what will come next now that Arecibo has met its demise.
So it was of use right till the very end. And by the way, one of the things you didn't mention, although there are a lot of things you could have mentioned, I guess, as to what this has done, it was able to discover correctly the rotation of Mercury.
That too, yeah. I mean, even the planets, and that discovery was one of the really, really early ones in the 1960s with Mercury. And what was so sad is that even young astronomy scientists were currently working on observing Mars. I mean, we send spacecrafts to Mars. We have satellites that examine Mars. Even the Hubble looks at Mars, but not necessarily in the radio waves. And Arecibo was uniquely place to be able to see Mars. And this year, Mars was at its closest that it has been in many years, and won't get as close until the year 2067. And so, you know, the young astronomers were really looking forward to examining that planet in a way that we can't do even with NASA's greatest, satellites and rovers wouldn't be able to do. And it can't, obviously, now they're looking for other ways of potentially doing that kind of work now.
Well, I know, as the saying goes, the horse is gone, so why close the barn door? But the question has to be asked, if this was such an important observatory, and it was, why wasn't anything done to maintain its structure so that it could withstand what eventually brought it down, which essentially is gravity?
Well, that's it. And actually, there's a lot of rumblings in the radio astronomy community and finger pointing, they're saying, going on, that the folks at the National Science Foundation in the United States that was really funding this really pulled back the purse strings in the last few years. I mean, originally their funding was at $14 million a year, and that had been decimated down to $2 million a year, which was not enough to even keep up the maintenance of this. And, you know, it was already falling into disrepair. Arecibo was damaged back in 2017 because of the Hurricane Maria that blew over Puerto Rico and caused so much devastation on the island, really caused a lot of damage even then. And so they over the years they've packed in more instruments on board that platform that collapsed now, that 910 ton platform really wasn't made to withstand that kind of stressors. And so you would think that they would upgrade it, but they never did the proper maintenance on this aging facility. This was a, you know, so it's crazy because Arecibo was really so critical to so many different fields in astronomy and astrophysics. It's going to really be a big loss. And the question now is where are we going? I mean, Arecibo held the title as being the largest facility up until the year 2016, the largest radio telescope in the world. And that was replaced by China's huge 500-meter radio telescope that they built. And so the question is America going to step up and rebuild something? That's now just starting those talks are just starting to come to light.
Well, to rub up your crystal ball, do you think they will rebuild someplace, if not there, someplace else? Or is this something that the United States won't be doing anymore?
I think if they're going to rebuild, I think it'll be a consortium. That goes more of an international consortium between many countries. As we're seeing with many other telescope facilities around the world, they're these mega monster-sized ones that are going to be coming online in the next few years around the world are really multinational affairs. I think to be able it's not going to be rebuilding what existed. I think they'll want to probably build something comparable to what the Chinese have built or one up them, actually.
And location-wise, what is the best location for something like this?
Well, it's interesting because Arecibo location was very ideal because it was picked because it was near the equator. And that allows them to see a lot of really cool things in the universe in that particular location, just because of how Earth is oriented in the solar system, in the Milky Way. It allows scientists to see very clearly to the center of our galaxy, allows them to see very clear views of all the planets that literally pass overhead of this facility. So I would think, you know, they would have a good reason to rebuild it. The scientific infrastructure is already there in Puerto Rico, so it's now it would be just a matter of seeing if how to rebuild with newer technology.
Always a pleasure to have you on. It's kind of sad that it's on an occasion like this when we lose what is definitely an icon of astronomy. But thank you very much, Andrew, for being on the program with us once again.
My pleasure. Clear skies.
Andrew Fazakis, the night sky guy and author of National Geographic's Backyard Guide to the Night Sky. You can check out his website at thenightskyguy.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0590. And you'll find links to his site and also links to either Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. Also, by the way, he has on his website a different version of the collapse of that observatory telescope, which was taken by a drone. Check it out. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File Program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. Viewer discretion is advised. But then again, why are you staring at a radio program?
And still to come on the program, Mark Hartzman from WeirdHistorian.com is back to share an odd story for the month of December. Plus, Paul J.J. Payak from Global Language Monitor has the 2020 trending words. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way. And a lot more Stuff File news here on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere and can be heard on all your devices, including Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, just to name a few. And as I mentioned earlier, you can hear every episode, all almost 600 of them, well, 590 now, on the Stuff File website at thestufffile.com. Let's get back to the stuff, shall we? By now you've probably heard the news where at least 41 people contracted COVID-19 at a Louisiana annual swingers convention called Naughty Nollins. This brings new meaning to the term super spreader. Organizers had attempted to create a scaled-down COVID-safe bubble after more than 6 months of virtual events. Now the event organizer says dozens of attendees have tested positive for coronavirus. In a blog post, event organizer Bob Hannaford said his team went to extraordinary measures to try to ensure the safety of attendees, including speaking with city and state officials, implementing a touchless check-in process, required temperature checks, social distancing, required masks in public, no dance floor, wristbands indicating COVID status, and sanitation. Yes, but it still ended up in the sharing of bodily fluids with strangers, so really, what was the point of all that precaution? Anyway, Hannaford said that 50% of attendees tested positive for COVID-19 antibodies, suggesting they'd already had it. Hannaford said he believed they were hosting the safest possible event. Wow, you're engaging in sex with total strangers, and you consider this to be safe. How exactly? By the following week, email started pouring in with positive test results, tallying up to at least 41 infections out of about 250 to 300 attendees, a positivity rate between 13 and 16%. Hannaford said that most of the cases had been asymptomatic or mild, but at least one attendee was hospitalized in serious condition. Hannaford said attendees were encouraged to keep diaries of all interactions during the event, regardless of whether that contact involved sex. Those diaries are currently being used to carry out aggressive contact tracing. Now, lest you think that it's only Americans who get their COVID kink on, let me take you to Brussels, the site of the daddy orgy that was busted. Yes, it's called the Daddy Orgy. Guests at the Brussels Daddy Orgy thought the police who arrived to break up the party were part of the romp. David Mislely said some of the 30 male guests had tried to unzip the pants of the policemen because they thought that the raid was part of the orgy after the event at his Brussels apartment was shut down last Friday. Now, while the orgies are normally entirely legal, police closed down Friday's party because it was breaking lockdown rules, following what David suspected was a tip-off by a rival sex party organizer in Brussels. Wow, how many of these things are out there? Anyway, David's guests included Hungarian MEP Josef Zeyer, a married conservative politician who has supported anti-LGBT measures and who allegedly tried to escape through a window when police arrived. Oh, how sweet. Daddy has some explaining to do. And while we're on LGBT, let me share one more story that has that tinge to it, shall we? After Francis Cogella said it was repugnant to require schools to teach students LGBT history, hundreds of parents and even some officials sought her resignation from the Hackensack, New Jersey Board of Education. They didn't get it. But that was in 2019. In 2020, the era of Zoom meetings, things changed for Cogella. In the electronic presence of almost 150 people, while the board was hearing public comments, Cogella, not realizing her laptop's camera was still streaming, carried it into her bathroom to pee. This scandal brought her resignation the next day. Well, this proves that if you want someone to resign over something, first make sure it's something they agree is bad. She was caught going, and now she's gone. Anyway. Let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Mark Hartzman, author of The Big Book of Mars and the curator of the website WeirdHistorian.com, is back for his monthly visit featuring a weird moment in history for the current month. Let's see what he can dig up for the month of December. Mark joins us once again via Skype from New York. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for doing this once again.
Of course.
So what have you dug up?
Well, I have a, well, speaking of digging up, I have a good Christmas story that's literally about being dug up. It's a Christmas story, not from Charles Dickens, but from Charlie Chaplin. He died on Christmas Day in 1977. He was aged 88. He was living in Switzerland at the time. And he was buried, and then he was dug up. And this kind of thing, you know, robbing the grave was something that used to be a pretty lucrative business. This was done often in the 1800s. You know, grave robbers would go dig up a body and they'd sell it to an anatomist who would pay them to go study the body, you know, have a fresh corpse to go through. But this was more recent, 1977, and those sort of days were kind of gone. But these guys, a couple of Eastern Europeans, got a new idea to rob a grave and then ask for a ransom. So they thought they could cash in on the death of Charlie Chaplin. And they'd heard about this happening, I think, recently in Italy, and the guy got a bunch of money for digging up, you know, a body and getting a ransom for it. So they thought, this is a great idea. So they go out, you know, late at night. They dig up the grave. He had a 300-pound oak coffin, and they pull it out of the grave. And then they put it on their little truck, and they drive all the way out to a cornfield, you know, far from the home in Switzerland. And they reburied it. And then they call up Charlie's wife, his widow, whose name was Una, and they have this ransom demand, which was 1 million francs, which was roughly like 600,000 American dollars.
Now, when they dug up Charlie, did they take the casket too, or just Charlie?
I think they dug up the whole coffin.
Okay.
The whole thing. So they, like I said, then they buried it in a cornfield, which the whole thing just sounds, you know, ridiculous. Anyway, so they make the call to Una Chaplin, the widow, and they give these ransom demands, and she says no, which I'm sure quite surprised them. What do you mean no? And I think, you know, she had a comment. She said, I think Charlie would have found it rather humorous. I think she just thought the whole thing was absurd, and, you know, she's not going to pay them. So they lowered the ransom to $250,000, and she still said no. She's like, no, I'm not paying this. This is ridiculous. So what she did do, of course, was get the police involved. And the police were able to trace the body snatcher's calls. They tracked him down. And sure enough, they got a confession from these two guys. So anyway, had the Chaplin family actually paid, if Una gave in to these demands, they would have had another problem, which was these two guys couldn't remember where they buried the body in the cornfield. So they lost it. So their plan was really a mess. So the police were able to use a mine detector and they could search for it. And so by this was all, you know, obviously months after he had died. This was by May of 1978. They finally found Charlie Chaplin once again. And these two guys, they were charged with attempting to, you know, extort ransom and also for disturbing the peace of the dead, which is an interesting law. So Chaplin was then put back in his original grave. And this time they put a whole slab of concrete over it to really make sure it was secured. So no one else could have another crazy idea to try to extort some money from the chaplains.
Well, the charge that they were hit with is not that unusual, because I know, for instance, in the United States, many states have a charge that's called abuse of corpse.
Hmm.
So that's rather common.
It's unfortunate to think that that's common and that the law is even necessary, but, you know, like I said, it used to be a popular thing to dig up bodies. And in fact, there not only was it digging up bodies, but people used to be afraid of being buried alive. And there were caskets made with all sorts of devices to be able to alert someone if you were alive, you know, bells. That's where Saved by the Bell comes from. You could ring a bell and the you know, grave digger would come dig you back up, or someone would come dig you back up, hopefully. So there were lots of issues in the past with corpses, but one would think that we're past those days, but apparently not.
And by the way, when I say the term abuse of corpse, that is far reaching. That is not just snatching a body. That's doing anything that would be considered abusive to a corpse.
It does have a wide range of possibilities there, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The imagination can go in some disturbing places.
And not even the disturbing ones. You know, some people have been known to have somebody sitting up in a chair as a dead person. That is still abuse of corpse. So
I suppose so. There's some, there's, you know, if it's preserved properly, there's something kind of interesting about that.
Now, as you mentioned, he died on Christmas Day. How, and he wasn't found until May 17th. How soon after he was buried was he dug up?
I think it was shortly after. So this whole thing went on for a few months.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, he died, you know, died from a stroke. He was 88 years old. He'd passed away in his sleep. Obviously had a long and prosperous life, you know, one of the first movie stars ever, right when film started. So, you know, incredibly famous guy. So you can imagine why these two men would think that there was a big reward in it for them, you know, big payday.
So Charlie was on tour. I just find it rather humorous, the fact that these two guys couldn't remember where they had buried him. It's like they were the bumbling thieves from Home Alone.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you could almost just imagine Charlie Chaplin's ghost, like in the Tramp character that he was so famous for, sort of stumbling on and kind of watching the whole thing and, you know, twirling his cane and just sort of participating in these, you know, and these antics that were just absurd, you know, and kind of laughing at the whole thing.
Now, as you mentioned,
but yeah, it's a crazy scene.
As you mentioned, Charlie went back to his resting place, but they secured it with a slab of concrete, right?
Yeah. So, you know, and it seems to have worked. As far as I know, there have been no other reports of theft of his grave. So he seems to be resting in peace at last.
Yes. Plus, I think anybody who tried to steal him now, I think somebody would hear the jackhammer.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, it's an interesting way to come to a conclusion in one's notoriety with all the things that Chaplin had done in his career, both as a filmmaker and an activist and politically, that always kept him in the news. So he was in the news all through his life, and he was in the news in death as well.
It is really fitting, isn't it? And it's almost like in such a farcical way also, you know, so it kind of takes, you know, it's this whole newsworthiness and the whole comedy of the whole, you know, the whole comedic nature of this, of the nonsense that happened. It does make it a pretty fitting end, you know, one final Charlie Chaplin story, one last chapter.
This is why I have a prearrange. I'm going to be cremated. I've already paid for my funeral. I paid for it 20 years ago. The only thing they need to do is chisel in the right dates. That's it. I'm all set.
It's simplified.
And on that morbid note, best of the holiday season to you.
Thanks so much. You too. Happy holidays.
Thank you very much for being on the program with us once again, Mark.
Of course. Happy to do it.
Mark Hartzman, author of The Big Book of Mars. His website is weirdhistorian.com. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0590, and you'll find the link to Mark's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, coming to you from Montreal, Canada, where we share the longest unprotected border in the world with the United States. Take that as a sign of extreme friendship or a warning.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to Paul J.J. Payak from Global Language Monitor about the 2020 trending words. Guess what's the most trending word? Yeah, you're right. Also, we do have an Idiot of the Day coming your way and much more Stuff File news here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, a hunter tracking a deer in the Czech Republic was surprised when the buck circled back right to him. The rifle, which the hunter had slung over his left arm and fortunately without ammo, slipped onto the deer's antlers after the deer was startled by the man's dogs and charged him. It then ran off into the woods with the snag .22 caliber rifle on its antlers and disappeared. Police believe the story because another hunter about a kilometer away also called them to report seeing a deer armed with a rifle. Police are asking the public to call them if they spot the armed deer or an abandoned .22 Hornet rifle. Do you think this could be the beginning of a deer revenge plot? Kind of reminds me of my favorite Bugs Bunny cartoon, Bully for Bugs. You know, the one where the bull swallows a shotgun and starts shooting bullets out of its horns? Yeah, that was back in the day before some snowflake decided those cartoons were too violent and kids would try to emulate them. Like we were all 9-year-olds ordering anvils and also bombs that looked like bowling balls with wicks out of them from the Acme catalog. The destruction of a cheese wall near the construction site of the U.S.-Mexican border wall has left an artist curdling with anger. Canadian-Italian artist Cosimo Cavallero is seeking legal action against a federal contractor who allegedly destroyed his art installation made of cheese bricks situated near the border wall. According to Cavallero, he built the cheese wall out of Mexican cotija in late 2018 to protest President Trump's border wall. According to court papers, Cavallero is suing a Texas-based construction company, accusing them of trespassing on the site of his cheese wall and burying it with bulldozers. The court filings noted that Cavallero built a 6-foot-high, 3-foot-wide, and 70-foot-long wall out of 400 cheese blocks in southeastern San Diego. It was reportedly located on private land 10 yards from the real border wall. Okay, he built this in 2018 at the border in San Diego. It gets pretty hot in that area. How gamey was that cheese wall? Is it possible that it was torn down for environmental reasons? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest, our last guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, an unnamed North Korean man in his late 20s told officials his training as a gymnast enabled him to jump almost 10 feet high over a fence on November 3rd to escape into South Korea. After crossing the fence, the man evaded capture for about 14 hours before being detained by South Korean soldiers whom he told he wanted to defect. Skeptical officials made him jump the same height again twice to help prove his story. He did. Amazingly, he successfully avoided landmines and sensors around the border. I get the feeling the South Koreans just found themselves a ringer for next summer's Olympic gymnastic team. I also get the feeling that the remaining gymnasts in North Korea are about to have their feet bound. Anyway, let's get to our last guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? There's no denying that 2020 is a year like no other, a year focused on one thing for most of the world. So it would come as no surprise that the trending words of the year all have something to do with the ongoing pandemic we're all living through. As usual, at this time of year, we're joined by Paul J.J. Payak, the president and chief word analyst at Global Language Monitor and the founding president of YourDictionary.com. He joins us via Skype from Austin, Texas. Hi, Paul.
Hey, good to talk to you again. We've been doing this for a long time, so our listening to your podcast actually gives you a history of the 20th century word usage.
Absolutely. And as a matter of fact, we started talking on my old radio show back in the day. You've been doing this since the turn of the century, so it's now 21 years and counting, correct?
Yeah, it's really interesting because what we did when we started it, we thought, okay, we're doing awards at a year. And then as we got through to 2010, we said, oh, now it's the first year, the top words of the decade. Now it's the first two decades. Now it's the top words of the century. So it's becoming a very valuable archive. In fact, we have scholars coming to us and studying what we've done to look to reflect the word usage of how the world is speaking, what topics it's talking about, and things of that nature. Even though it's English, but in English, as you know, there's 2-3 billion English speakers out there, and it is the global language.
Now, with the year that we've been having with COVID, does this compare to any other year? And by that I mean, was there any year where certain words were so overridingly the major choice of the words of the year because of what they reflected for that particular year? Or is COVID unique?
Not even close, right. We've had, in some instantiations, we've had over a billion citations. We've never seen anything close to that. A billion citations worldwide, there's 7 billion people on Earth. So that just gives you an idea to scale. And we've never had anything that was so globally focused. It's always focused on English language, which covers a lot of the globe. But this covers everything. You know, you just look at the COVID map of the world right now from Johns Hopkins University, and it's truly frightening.
So for 2020, what are the biggest words and or phrases for the year?
Okay, well, the biggest words and or phrases, as you imagine, it'd be COVID, okay, COVID-19. It's all different variations of COVID.
Right.
Okay, so we have COVID-19, COVID, and coronavirus at number 3, 4, and 6. Number 1 is work at home. That was a surprise to us. It's a phrase, but work at home has come on so strongly. What we did is we took our first snapshot in June and May, and we tried to see, as soon as the government lockdown started, we said we better lock in what's happening. So we did a full-blown analysis, top to down, and the idea was to get a snapshot of where things were then and how they are now. And so it's really interesting. So if you go to the site, you can actually see how things have moved. For example, at mid-year, work at home, which is now number 1, was number 29. It wasn't even in top 10, okay? And WHO, which is the World Health Organization, is number 2 now. And back at mid-year, it was 35. Of course, COVID-19 was number 1, okay? And so you can see that hasn't moved much. And then we have one political thing in there, and that's MAGA. That's from President Trump's Make America Great Again theme. And it's amazing how no matter what's going on in the world, they always have some politics intervening.
Now, right? I find that one interesting only because we're talking top words of 2020 for worldwide English. I'm surprised that MAGA is quite frankly that high, only because I was surprised that, let's be honest, it was something of interest in other parts of the world.
Right. Well, at the initial snapshot, it was 38. And it's because we took the second snapshot right in the middle of all the election and the chaos and things like that, that it moved up in the rest of the world. Mm.
Now, I noticed that number...
It's where it should have been, number 38 in June.
Right. Now, we are talking via Skype, but I noticed that number 7 is a Skype competitor, and that is Zoom.
Yes, that's a big one. And it's mostly because business worldwide is switching over to Zoom meetings. I talked to a teacher down in Washington, D.C., she said they had to cancel their meeting because they had 128 people on the Zoom meeting, and you're looking at all those faces. And they just had to get it down to something manageable. But most people have kind of intimate conferences of 15, 20 people, maybe 10, even 5. But it's a good way to connect during the coronavirus. People have been finding it effective. The stock's been going up, and Zoom made it. Let's see where we were. It was
Well, to recap, the number one was work at home. Two was WHO. Three was COVID-19. Four was COVID. Five was MAGA. Six is coronavirus, as you mentioned. Zoom is number seven. So the last three in the top 10, 8, 9, and 10, are in the order new normal, the virus, and trade war.
Exactly. And all those were up a lot, except for trade war, which actually fell. Okay, it fell one spot from 9 to 10. But new normal and the virus, again, in May and June, it was new, right? It was the new normal. And the virus was just starting to be spoken of as a truly frightening pandemic. We've been calling it the plague lately because people can relate to the word plague a lot better than to the pandemic.
Now I see. Let's just go to all the way to 15. Number 11 is Black Lives Matter. Number 12 is face mask. Number 13 is Corona. Number 14 is progress, and number 15 is truth. Why progress and truth?
It's interesting because it's been such a debate worldwide over the last, say, 10 years. Is there such a thing as progress, okay, in world history? And there's been academic arguments on, is that like a vestige from the 18th, 19th century? And the answer is yes, it is. But still, when you test it, it's very high, very high. And truth is very high because people are looking at fake news and things of that nature. And so it has remained very high. In fact, you get our top words of the century in another couple of weeks, and you'll see that both truth and progress are very high for the century now.
As a matter of fact, you mentioned fake news, and that came in at number 17, right?
Yes. So, fake news came in at 17, and it was 38. So fake news with the pandemic, you know, there's been so many false reports, et cetera, that fake news has gone up mightily. I should mention that in February, before anybody was talking about the pandemic, what we did is, since we're global and we're a data research company, you know, we focus on words, but we do data research focused on words. We found by going to China and Hong Kong, we got their statistics and looked at exactly if this is what's going on, how does a plague normally progress? So we took all the scientific numbers we can. We had stuff from UK-based medical journals like Nature, et cetera, and we took the best numbers we could, compensated for what was thought to be the underplay and undercount by the government of China. So, and then we extrapolated out. And we did that as a scorecard so people could actually see, if nobody intervenes, what happens? And so just take the course of any other plague that we've had in history, at least since like zero AD, right? We went to some Roman plagues, et cetera. And it turned out that right now we'd have 10 times as many deaths if there was no intervention. Wow. So there's a lot of controversy on, have we been doing enough? Do the lockdowns work? You know, et cetera, et cetera. Well, if you just extrapolate the data from the beginning, it's an order of 10 magnitude less, fewer deaths than it would have occurred if nothing happened.
Mm. Now, we talk to you every year around this time, and we explain what the Global Language Monitor is. But I've got just about a minute. We've never talked about yourdictionary.com. Very quickly, tell us about that.
Well, yourdictionary.com, I founded that back in 1999 with two colleagues. And basically, one of my old professors in college had this thing he called the Web of Online Dictionaries. Okay. And over time, and he founded it like in 5 years before, so in the early 90s. And over time, it ended up being the largest selection of online dictionaries of any language you could imagine. Okay. It had like 400 or 500 different languages. It still does. But anyhow, so what we did is we bought it from Professor Beard, Richard Beard, and we bought that, and then we transformed it into a dictionary that ordinary people could use. that still had the breadth of all the different languages if they wanted to use it. And then from that, I saw the media analysis factors that we were doing at Your Dictionary or early analyses at all. And I thought, this is really interesting. So I split off Global Language Monitor to just do the media analytics. And that's what we've been doing. We did that in 2003 that we split it off.
Paul, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Best of the holiday season to you, and looking forward to better and bigger things for 2021. Certainly couldn't.
2021 should be very interesting word-wise.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, sir.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Paul J.J. Payak from Global Language Monitor. Again, you can visit their website at languagemonitor.com. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0590, and you'll find the link to Paul's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
20-year-old Daniel M. Rizza of McKeesport, Pennsylvania, driving a gray Audi SUV, ran out of gas on November 27th and called state police to ask for help. But when he was told a trooper would be responding, he abruptly said he'd changed his mind and hung up. The trooper responding to the call learned en route that a gray Audi had been reported stolen nearby earlier in the day, and after a check of the SUV's make, model, identification number, and registration, he arrested Rizza, who was charged with a felony count of receiving stolen property. Now, why, oh why? If you were driving a stolen car and you ran out of gas, would you call the police for help? And even after you realized just how dumb a move that was, would you wait around with the vehicle to see who showed up? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0590. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0590. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, Verdant Square Radio, KDXRadio.com, PCJ Radio International at its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, CKUW-FM in Winnipeg, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. No animals were harmed in the production of this program, except, of course, the tasty ones. Good night and pass the paprika.